welcome. And the sheets are over here in the middle. If some can make sure just to pass them, maybe they should be situated in a little bit of a more convenient location. Maybe on the ends. People are coming in. Okay. Thank you very much for coming out early in the morning on a Sunday morning. There were more than one person looked at the original email that I sent out with this and said, "Are you sure it's AM and not PM?" They're not used to Sunday morning minyan, evidently. But I want to thank the Bayit for hosting and co-sponsoring the program, as well as the Law Society of Upper Canada for accrediting us for 1 1/4 professionalism credits. You see two links on the top of the handouts, on top of the sheets. And if you don't have the sheets, they are now there at that end, I think. But there are two links on there. One link is an online evaluation, which we have on the website of the program that I represent, the Yeshiva University Torah Mitzion Beit Midrash, and that's for general feedback on the program. It's helpful if you fill that out, not required. And then the other is for a great link. I owe a lot to Professor Steven Reznikoff of DePaul University College of Law for an article that he wrote, which is available online at that link, obviously, which gave me a lot of background to work with to get me started on preparing the talk for this morning. It should be noted, and I always say this in terms of classes in Jewish law, but I'm now going to double it in terms of general law as well, that this is, I am not a lawyer. This is not intended to be advice in law. For all practical matters, see your lawyer and or rabbi. Or if you are a lawyer, then I don't know, talk to yourself. Unlike the last session that we did, which was on confidentiality, which contrasted systems, we're going to be spending most of our time on Jewish law and how it responds to the secular institution of bankruptcy. This will obviously necessarily require some explanation of bankruptcy as an institution and so on. The professionalism credit for the class is based on the issue of sensitivity to the demands of a client's particular religion, and I want to address three particular questions that come up in that regard. Question number one, does Jewish law recognize a secular bankruptcy discharge? Question number two, if I were a Jewish lawyer with a Jewish client, under Jewish law, would I be permitted to file for bankruptcy on behalf of my client or to help my client to file a proposal for bankruptcy? And then third, if my Jewish client is filing for bankruptcy and is concerned about the potential of someone pursuing him afterwards in a rabbinical court, in a Beit Din, what can I do to protect him from challenge in that Beit Din after the bankruptcy proposal has been filed? So those are the three pieces that I would like to get to in the next 1 1/4. Please do feel free to interrupt with questions. Please do feel free to interrupt with advice on points of bankruptcy that I am missing or that I didn't understand properly, because that may well happen. We begin with a discussion of whether Jewish law recognizes a secular bankruptcy discharge. So we have within Judaism a mitzvah of, a commandment of, repaying debt. And the only debate is where it comes from. Meaning the Talmud states explicitly that there is a mitzvah of repaying debt, that it is an obligation. It's in Ketuvot 86a. There's a discussion there even of compelling someone to pay back a debt in the event that he is refusing. So that we know. The only question is, which biblical verse is it that makes this that creates this requirement? And I brought you a few sources. If you take a look at source number one, this is from the commentary of Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzhaki, writing in the 11th century in France. And he links it to a biblical verse from the book of Vayikra of Leviticus, in which we are told to maintain efas tzedek behin tzedek, honest weights and measures. So one of the honest measures is called a hin. A hin is a volume measure. And the sages were bothered when they read this this biblical verse that lists the honest weights and measures you need to have, because the list is redundant. It includes more than one volume measure. In other words, if you can imagine in a you know, general setting, if someone told you, you must make sure that your liter measurements are honest, and you must make sure that your half liter measurements are honest, are precise. So really, you don't need to say that to someone. Once they know their liter measurements have to be precise, they know their half liter measurements have to be precise. Unless you're dealing with a really fine legal document that's going to make sure to spell out everything. And the biblical text generally doesn't get that fine in its detail. So based on that, the sages of the Talmud said, there's a play on words that is intended here. The word for this volume measure is hin, and a word that's classically used for saying yes in Jewish law is hein. And so we link the word hin and hein and say that just like your hin, your volume measure has to be precise and honest. If you sell someone a hin of beer or a hin of whatever it is, it has to be precise. So too your hein, your yes, has to be precise. Meaning when you say yes, it has to mean yes. And when you say no, it has to mean no. You have to stick to your word. And therefore, a person who takes out a loan must indeed repay the loan. That's the idea. Take a look at source number one, please, where the commentator Rashi says this in way fewer words. He says, the mitzvah of lefroach chovo ul'ameis divarav. There is an obligation for one to pay his debts and fulfill his words. Tichsev, he quotes the biblical verse, hin tzedek, you shall have an honest hin, this measurement. And we understand from that, sheyehei hein shalchat tzedek v'lav shalchat tzedek. Your hein, your yes shall be honest, and your no shall be honest as well. So you have to keep your word. However, in Jewish tradition, it's rarely that simple. In this case, it's not that simple because of a comment asked by the commentary on the Talmud called Tosfot. Tosfot is a collection of commentaries from the 12th to 13th century, some of them written by Rashi's own grandchildren. And they ask a question here, which I recorded in source number two, which is, I'm going to say it outside of the text, because I think it's easier to explain outside of it, but you can see it in number two. If the only reason I'm obligated under Jewish law to pay my debts is because I have to make sure that my word is honest, then really, that doesn't carry. It doesn't apply. Why? Because at the time that I took out the loan, I fully intended to repay. My yes was honest. And at this time, I don't plan to repay. And my no is also honest. I was honest when I said I was going to pay because I did my best. And I'm honest now when I tell you I'm not going to pay. And therefore, I'm sticking to my word entirely. The word changed. But the intent was sincere all the way down the line. So in that case, what is the source for the requirement that I pay my debts? In source number two, Rabbi Yom Tov Elashvili, also known as Ritva, writing in Spain in the 13th century, explained that it's from a different verse, a verse in Deuteronomy, which talks about claiming payment from someone. And the rule is that in the event that the person gives me security for a debt, and it's the type of security which the person needs on a regular basis, so I'm not allowed to hold it. He has to give it back to me when it's not in his when he's not using it. The rule that the biblical text says is I'm not allowed to go into his house to get it. I have to wait outside, and he will bring it out to me. So the biblical verse, which is quoted in source number two, says, the man from whom you are claiming, the person who owes you the money, shall bring the collateral out to you. So normally we understand the emphasis in that verse to mean that I have to wait outside while he brings it to me. But he's taking it as an imperative, as this person shall bring the collateral out to you. He's obligated, the borrower is obligated to bring this item out to you, the security for the debt. And so that's a second source. Then there's a third source from Rabbi David Ibn Abi Zimra, the Radbaz, an authority of the 15th century in Spain. And he offers me another source. He says it's the biblical verse, Ve'ishivas Hagzela Asher Gazal. The biblical verse says that if someone steals something, he has to return it. The money that somebody owes somebody else is considered to be as though it is stolen. It is in his possession inappropriately, even though it came to him 100% legitimately. And he bases himself on the fact that Maimonides, in his code of law, his Mishneh Torah, links together all sorts of monies that a person possesses inappropriately. You can see it there in source number 3. Again, I'm not going to read it aloud, but you have it there on the sheet. But he links together Gozel, Oshek, Gonev as the different types of theft and corrupt means of possessing somebody else's funds, as well as Hilvo, if a person lent him money, or Hifkid Etzlo, somebody gave him something to watch and he held on to it inappropriately. So just like there is a commandment to return stolen goods, so too there is a commandment to pay back debts. There are other sources that I could bring. These are just three illustrations. But the sages are of one mind that there is a religious duty, aside from a social obligation, to pay back when somebody has lent somebody money. There's a verse in Proverbs, Lo vera shava lo yishalim, that a person who borrows and does not repay is considered wicked. There are all sorts of sources. So what happens if a person can't? What happens if the person lacks the means of repaying the debt? So in contemporary law, there's a concept of bankruptcy. If you go way back, if you go back to the Code of Hammurabi, you find the possibility of liquidating a person's assets in order to pay the debt. That's something that's found in Torah as well. The idea that you can go into his property or get a court to go into his property and actually liquidate what he has to pay the debt. However, it doesn't seem within the Hammurabi Code. I was going to bring the secular material on here also, but when I hit five sides of pages, I said forget it. So I apologize. But you can do the research on this. It's out there. But in Hammurabi's code, I don't believe he has discharge of debt. In other words, he has that you can go and take stuff out of his property for payment. And he also has that if someone does not have the means to repay fully, you can imprison him or enslave him. He does not have the idea that once the person's assets are exhausted or responsibly disposed of, then it's discharged. That's not there. In the year 594 before the Common Era, Solon changes Athenian law to allow a debtor to forfeit his citizenship and then have his debts absolved. And that seems to be the earliest form of bankruptcy in which there's actually a discharge of debt without paying the entire obligation. And then the Justinian Code, moving forward 1,000 years to 6th century, allows for actual absolution of debts. The first formal bankruptcy statute I've been able to find is 1542 under Henry VIII. The theory behind bankruptcy, why is bankruptcy a good idea? From a secular perspective, leaving aside Jewish perspective, why does it make sense for society to allow somebody to discharge debt without actually paying it off?
Concept of forgiveness and a fresh start.
Who are you helping by having that?
The debtor.
So it benefits the debtor, because the debtor can now get a fresh start. That's one possibility. What else? I know it's early Sunday morning, but a lot of you are lawyers. You should be up and at 'em.
Society would be very hurt by people who are so hurt. It's going to be desperate people and all kinds of things. Family breakup, all kinds of things.
Right. So one other reason is to help society, because you reduce the incentive for criminal behavior. Leave aside in a family breakup in terms of the tension on this person as well. But you're also reducing the incentive for criminal behavior. If a person has debt and no way out other than paying, that person may well be induced to do all sorts of inappropriate things in order to pay it off. Sometimes society is better off saying, this debt is not going to be repaid. So that's another reason that's offered. Cheaper than jail for society. Correct. That's another point. And not just cheaper than jail, but cheaper than having an eternal debtor in general than society. If this person is going to have his wages garnished forever to pay back the debt, the result is society is going to be responsible to support this person in one way or another, and the impact on society is grave. There's more. You also help the creditor personally. Because envision a situation in which the debtor says, there's no way I'm going to be able to pay back this debt, and therefore becomes entirely uncooperative. Right? They'll conceal assets, they may run away entirely. This way they have some kind of means of getting back to square one, and maybe they'll become more cooperative, and the creditor will get something back as payment for the debt.
Talking about a proposal.
Proposal, correct. The other points within this that help society. Yeah.
So psychologically, also it allows credit closure for the creditor. If, as you say, if the debtor is going to conceal assets, and the creditor is going to be, you know, that's going to weigh on the creditor's mind for who knows.
Correct. There is that possibility also. The emotional health, if you will, of the creditor. Although I don't know how much that's worth, compared to the amount owed. But yeah, that's subjective. But also, there are other ways in which it helps society. Yes?
Sorry. Society takes partial responsibility for creating the environment for that situation to exist in the first place, for someone to accumulate that kind of debt.
Right. You mean in terms of the lending practices?
Exactly.
Right. So another point that is raised is that it encourages wise lending. Because on the one hand, you want people to extend credit. On the other hand, if you have people extend credit indiscriminately, right? Look at the housing bubble in the U.S. from a few years ago. The results are going to be disastrous for society. So you want to say to the creditor, you know, there's a possibility of bankruptcy, in which case you're going to lose the credit you're extending. Yes, there was a hand here.
To say the same thing was notice to the future creditors.
Right.
Person was bankrupt once upon a time, so.
Right, that's another point, is that it's a notice for the future in a way that's now on the record. Right, yes?
The person who's destitute doesn't spend.
Mm-hmm.
So if the debts are wiped out, then they get back to commercial society and they shop or they do business and if the creditor gives them a break, if they get money from the bankruptcy or proposal, they still have a customer.
Right.
So going forward, the person gets back into, hopefully not overspending, but still back into commercial society.
Correct. The person will be able to be back a productive member, hopefully, of the economy, and to which I would add that it will also encourage entrepreneurship in general. Knowing that you have the safety net, you know, granted that, it, depending on your bankruptcy laws, it can be pretty draconian. It depends on your system. But knowing that there is a safety net may help encourage people to actually engage in the entrepreneurship, which drives society, aside from the fact that this individual, where we're dealing with an individual borrower, is going to once again, hopefully, have a shot at being part of society in a productive way. There's an awful lot behind this in terms of all the different theories, and the theories matter for reasons that we're going to get to in terms of Jewish law recognition of a secular bankruptcy. So I'm not just discussing this because it's interesting, although it is, but the philosophy is actually going to matter a great deal. So what is contemporary bankruptcy procedure in a nutshell? Lawyers, feel free to correct me, but as I understand it, and I brought you a link that I used for a lot of this information under source number 4, bankruptcy is a legal process designed to relieve honest but unfortunate debtors of their debts. So the proposal is an offer made to the creditors to pay a percentage of what is owed over a specific period of time or to extend the length of time available to pay off the debt or some combination of both. Creditors vote to accept or reject the proposal. There are consumer proposals for individuals who owe less than $250,000 aside from mortgages. There are also commercial proposals. I'm not going to get into all the specifics of that, but once all the terms of the proposal are met, the debtor is legally released from the debts included in the proposal. Now, I underline debts included in the proposal because there are certain debts that can survive the bankruptcy proposal. So, for example, if there's a secured creditor, the creditor has a lien on particular assets, the bankruptcy proposal is not going to touch that, as I understand it. That's one of those points where I'm waiting for the lawyers to tell me I'm wrong, but that's my understanding. Okay. The debtor, as part of this proposal, is required to disclose all assets and property disposed of in the past few years, to surrender credit cards, to assist the trustee who administers the bankruptcy, to attend financial counseling. That's the basic system of filing for bankruptcy. And then the Office of the Superintendent of Bankruptcy oversees administration of the proposals under the Bankruptcy and Insolvency Act, which I linked for you in source number 4. There's more to say about this and about how we get priority among creditors, how that works within law as well. But it won't be directly relevant for what we're talking about now. That's all the secular bankruptcy system.
Oh, I would add one thing there. It's not every case that you have a proposal.
Okay.
If the creditors don't accept it, there's just a liquidation of all the assets except those that are exempt under bankruptcy law.
Right.
So you should be aware of that.
Right. So there could be a liquidation of everything.
Except the property that's exempt.
Right.
There are a few categories of exempt property.
Correct. I'm actually going to come up with that.
It's important to understand that you don't have proposals in every case. In many cases, there isn't one.
Got it. Okay, and I appreciate that. Thank you. Okay. Within the Jewish system, what do we have? So there is one source within Judaism that people popularly point to as a bankruptcy style law. And I brought it here in source number 6. It is a passage from Devarim, from Deuteronomy. It appears a couple of places in the Torah regarding what's called the Shemitah year, the sabbatical year. Note, a sabbatical year is actually coming up within the Jewish calendar, starting this coming Rosh Hashanah, which will be, I think, September 26, 27, somewhere around there, is a sabbatical year. And the way that the law works is, as described here, at the end of every 7 years, debts which are due and have not been repaid are nullified, are canceled. If it's already due, that's a key point, and it has not been repaid, then the debt is canceled. There are all sorts of exceptions to that rule, some built into the law, some developed further, which are beyond the scope of what we're going to get to right now. But some will point to that and say, see that, if every 7 years you're cleaning the slate, so that is sort of a kind of bankruptcy protection. Why is it not a kind of bankruptcy protection? Why is that not true?
If they were due.
Well, first of all, if they weren't due yet, then they're still out there. That's true. But it's extended to everybody equally. It has nothing to do with your means. You could be very capable and simply holding out, and it's going to be erased. So it's not a true bankruptcy statute. It resembles it in the sense of there's a desire to get society back to square one, but that's about it. Yes. Right. So I don't think it really does, because generally speaking, under Jewish law, the way that a person would indeed become an eved, right, a servant, is if they either stole something that they couldn't return, or they sold themselves on their own will. There's no concept of being sold by the court for payment of debts. That's not a means of that. I don't think it directly relates. We do find it in secular society and in other societies, but I don't think we find it within the Jewish system. The modern Hebrew phrase for bankruptcy, is anyone familiar with it? Right, poshet regel is to file for bankruptcy. So that's actually a Talmudic phrase. It's ksuvos kufches amud beis, but it's not talking about bankruptcy there. It's actually literally poshet regel is to extend a leg. That's literally what it means, and it's a rude gesture. When someone comes to you and demands payment, and you say forget it, evidently extending your leg was considered to be a way to demonstrate to someone forget it, you're not getting paid. But that phrase has become the term in Hebrew for bankruptcy, pshitat regel. I don't think so. I think it's literal there. Yeah, I think so. So the Jewish tradition generally says that the lender is required to be kind to the borrower. There are all sorts of protections for the borrower. For example, the most obvious example is the biblical rule of Cielo Kenosha, which says that if I extend a loan to somebody and I know that they can't repay, then I am not allowed to come to them for payment, even though it's already due. If I know they lack the means, I am prohibited from causing them angst by going to them for repayment. And even if I know that walking in front of them is going to disturb them, I'm supposed to not walk in front of them. To that extent, I'm supposed to protect the emotions and feelings of the debtor. And of course, within Jewish tradition, it's great to be kind to people and to say, I'm going to turn this into philanthropy and I'm simply going to forgive the debt if one can afford to do so. That's great. If one will claim a debt, there are rules governing how it will be done. I mentioned before the rule of the court going into the debtor's property to take the item, the security for the debt. There is something called in Hebrew sidur, which requires that the court arrange what will be taken for payment of a debt. And as you mentioned before, within the secular system, there's protected property, that which the person needs to be able to get by, that which the person needs for his trade. All of this is actually set out in Jewish law, that which cannot be touched for a collection of the debt. We will require that the debtor swear in court that he has no further assets, similar to the disclosure of assets. But you can't compel somebody to go to work. You cannot enslave somebody in order to have them earn more to use in payment. However, there is no biblical bankruptcy discharge, and down through the centuries, rabbinical courts have never instituted a discharge of debt. Now, that to me is very interesting because the rabbinical courts have innovated in all sorts of ways over the centuries. They've created institutions, sometimes mimicking that which existed in broader society when they felt that it was worthwhile. So they have the powers to do that. Hypothetically, a Jewish system could well have created bankruptcy. Why didn't they? Especially once they saw it in society around them, once it was evolving, and again, going back to the time of the Greeks, you have some means of that. Why didn't rabbinical courts create a system of bankruptcy?
Why would it have been necessary if there was a cancellation of debt every 7 years?
Because we know of the loopholes that will allow people to get around that. Right? I mean, the most simple one is called a Prose Bowl, in which one can actually assign the debts that are owed to oneself to a rabbinical court to collect. And at that point, and even if it's just a pro forma assignment, those debts will survive the sabbatical year. Sorry.
A Jewish system of bankruptcy would only apply if you're in a Jewish creditor and a Jewish lender. We've got no possibility of getting non-Jewish creditors to go along with a Jewish system of bankruptcy.
This is true. This is certainly true. And I think that is part of it. And I would extend that a little bit further and note that within Jewish tradition, loans were generally considered a form of charity. They were considered a form of tzedakah. The lending was considered financial aid more than it was considered a business proposition. Yes?
Hefker Basin have done that. We have been through Hefker Basin.
Hefker Basin and Hefker, right. Rabbinical courts have the ability to allocate funds, to take funds from one person and say, now these belong to somebody else. Yes?
I think that Jewish courts are very sensitive to perpetuating and maintaining the commercial system.
Right. Very true. This is consistent with Jewish economic policy, which historically has encouraged lending by boosting the powers of the lender. Remember, I noted it on your sheet. If you flip to the second side, source number 8 is a biblical verse that it appears in the context of a discussion of philanthropy, of tzedakah, and you see that it talks about lending. Im kesef tal ve'es ami, when you lend money to my nation, to the pauper with you, and so on, lending is considered to be philanthropic, and we want to encourage it, both for religious reasons and for the practical reason that it will help keep the economy going. And so we have all sorts of rules that are recorded in the Talmud that are meant to help encourage lending. So take a look, by boosting the powers of the creditor, take a look at source number 9 as one example. The Talmud records there that technically speaking, to adjudicate a matter between a creditor and a debtor, the rabbinical court should consist of 3 highly trained expert judges. However, the sages said, we're not going to require that. We will accept any 3 judges, regardless of their degree of training. Further, they said, normally, we require interrogation of witnesses in a very intense way in court. However, the intense interrogation is not needed when investigating the matter of a debt between parties. Why? So they give you the same answer for both in source number 9, to avoid locking the door before borrowers. Or in the original, in the Talmud, Kadesh lo tinol delas bifnei lovin. We don't want to lock the door in front of borrowers, meaning, in the event that you were to say that someone who wanted to collect on a debt had to find a court of 3 expert judges, and had to have the witnesses to the debt interrogated 20 different ways, the result would be people would think very carefully before extending a loan. Because they would say, why do I want to get into this? It's going to be so hard to get paid back. Add in the fact that within these loans, there's a no-interest policy, right? You're not allowed to charge interest. It's a losing proposition down the line. So people are going to say, I don't need to lend. I don't need the headache. There are further rules along these lines. I brought you just one example. But the fact that you're allowed to collect a debt from the heirs of the debtor is also a rule that the sages enacted in order to boost the powers of the lender. Certain rule changes in terms of the quality of property that one could demand for payment of a debt are meant, again, to intensify the powers that the lender has. So the Jewish economic system classically was biased on behalf of the lender in order to encourage no-interest lending as philanthropy to the borrower. Now, again, this is going to work within one society. Once you get beyond the Jewish society, and you're dealing with a non-Jewish creditor or a non-Jewish debtor, you're going to have trouble enforcing your system. But this is something that happens, so to speak, in-house. So creating bankruptcy legislation may have the advantage of encouraging borrowing, but it can chill lending. And that may be a reason why they never went this route. Another reason why they never went this route goes back to the beginning of what we talked about 20 minutes ago, when we said there's a religious duty to repay. Under the secular system, the obligation to pay your debts is a social obligation. It's between man and man. Right? Society is licensed to forgive it for the sake of a healthier society. However, if my obligation to repay is like those sources that we saw, the first three sources that we saw, which means it's between human being and God, then who gave society the right to forgive it? Who gave society the right to declare that you don't need to fulfill your obligation to God of repaying your debts? So for both of those reasons, at the least, we're not going to have a Jewish bankruptcy system, which brings us to starting to address the first of our three questions, which is, does Jewish law recognize bankruptcy discharge that occurs, whether liquidation or proposal, however you work it, that's done in a secular court? And the answer is yes. There are three ways in which Jewish law will end up, or may end up, I should say, recognizing the bankruptcy proposal. The first one, and the simplest, is compromise. In source number 10, I laid it out for you. By the way, if at any point a person finds that we're not clear in terms of the flow of things, flip to the back page, and you'll see I did a little summary at the bottom. So that little outline that should help, because there's a lot of material that we're working through here. But the first way in which bankruptcy may be acceptable is simply through compromise, where it's done with the borrower and the lenders working together and agreeing. This is what's called in Hebrew, pshara. And rabbinical courts are encouraged to try to find compromise. I brought it for you in source number 11. I will not read it aloud, just in the interests of time. But the idea of compromise is enshrined in Jewish legal tradition and certainly recognized, whether it happens in a Jewish court or it happens in a secular court. Yes?
Bankruptcy is not it's forced. There's no compromise.
Correct. So we're going to have to come back to that question.
You got a million, your debts are a million, your assets are 100,000, you're getting 10 cents on the dollar, and that's it.
Right.
No spirit of compromise.
Right. So the weakness in this would be if the creditor would claim, I was compelled. So I want to come back to that in the third question so how do you protect your client who has filed for bankruptcy from being pursued afterwards in a rabbinical court when the creditor says, I only did that because I was forced to. So I'm going to come to that question. Another point that's worth noting is the term in Hebrew, kinyan. Kinyan is a term for transaction. And what it means here is really maasei kinyan, a deed of transaction, which is, as we're going to see much later on, that when one engages in such a compromise, there may be a requirement that they do it with an act that Jewish law recognizes as, so to speak, sealing a deal. An act of transaction. It's easy to do. It may be as simple as picking up a pen to demonstrate that you accept the terms of something. It depends on the context. But it's worth noting that you can't just assume that an agreement between creditor and debtor in a secular court is automatically going to be accepted as a compromise. There may be a need for that physical act to take place. Yes?
Would you use the word settlement as a synonym for compromise? Would you use the term proposal in the bankruptcy sense as synonyms for pshara?
Yes, but keeping in mind Mark's point about the person claiming he was compelled. In other words, true pshara, true compromise, inevitably results from a person on both sides giving something up because they feel they don't have any other means, right? That's always going to be the case. Meaning, whatever your setting is, forget bankruptcy. I threw a ball through somebody's window, and I owe him the amount of money to replace the window. But for whatever reason, let's say I think I can replace the window for X, and he wants it to be done in a nicer way, and he wants Y, and the court says, you know what, you're going to have to meet somewhere in the middle. That's also a compromise in which a person's going to say, well, I was compelled. You may have been compelled, but that's the system we work with. So that's not true compulsion. You have to figure out how to define compulsion a little bit more in a little bit of more refined way. But the first option basically would be, yes, the proposal, or even potentially the liquidation, and calling that settlement compromise. That would be one way to do it.
You mentioned the requirements of the Kenya that meets the definition. How about Minhag Sofrin?
We're getting there.
You're getting there. Okay.
Good. Excellent. Good question, and we're getting there. It's what I called on the sheet standard practice. The second way that this could be recognized in a Jewish court, even if it was not achieved via this Pshara compromise method, is what's called Dina de Malchusa, also known as the law of the land or government law. And we have a basic principle within Judaism. I brought it for you in source number 12. Again, I'm not going to read it inside the text in the interests of time. But the basic principle is that the law of the land is binding. In the context there, they're dealing with the question of whether one considers tax money that has been paid stolen goods, because the government is taking the money inappropriately. And the Talmud says, well, how would you consider that stolen goods? The government has the authority to collect taxes. And their answer is, we distinguish between a government tax collector and what's called a tax farmer. Tax farming was the practice in which people would purchase the right to collect taxes and keep them for themselves. And the government would sell it to them, figuring we're never going to be able to collect everything owed to us, and it's going to require a major investment for us. So we'll sell somebody the right to collect the taxes, and he can do it for himself. And what traditionally happened was the tax farmer then did whatever he wanted. He wasn't bound by any rules, or almost any rules, depending on the society. And then he would just take from this one, I think you should pay me this, and from this one, I think you should pay me that. And it was relatively arbitrary, and therefore it wasn't recognized. It was considered theft within Jewish society. So they distinguish between the tax farmer's action, which is not considered legal, and the government action, which is considered legal. And so we have this principle of Dina de Malchusa Dina. The law of the land is the law. Why does the government have the ability to do this beyond the realm of Jewish law? There are various legal theories. One theory is linked to source number 13. Source number 13 also requires some explanation outside of the text, so I will do that. It describes here the cities of Moab being conquered by the Amorites and then conquered by the Jews on their way into the land of Canaan in biblical text. The Jews were warned, don't go to war with Moab. That was a rule they were given. Moab is actually a relative of the Jews. It's a long story. You're told, don't go to war against Moab. And yet, they go to war and they take certain cities which had originally been Moabite cities. What's the justification? And the answer is because in between, those cities had been transferred to the Amori, another tribe, who was apparently fair game, for reasons way beyond the scope of this lecture. But the point is that because they were conquered by the Amori, they're not considered Moabite cities anymore. Now they're considered Amorite cities, from which we understand that in the event that there's a change in government, that is going to be recognized within Judaism, simply right of conquest. Whoever conquers the land is now considered to be the owner of it. It is now their football, so to speak, and they can make whatever rules they wish for the land that is under their authority. That's one basic reason why the law of the land is the law. It's theirs. The government gets to make the rules. And so you have to live by whatever rules they're going to create. There are limitations, such as the law of the land cannot tell you to directly contradict the Torah. So for example, if the Torah says don't eat pork, and the government says all citizens must eat pork on Thursdays, then the answer is going to be no. Law of the land cannot bring you in direct opposition to the law of the Torah, but other than that, the law of the land will be binding. It's a very broad power, obviously. There was a question on that? I thought I saw a hand.
I have a quick question.
Yeah.
Let's say, for the sake of argument or hypothetical, a business person plans to take money from his suppliers, declare bankruptcy, and essentially commit gzela.
Stealing.
It passes through the bankruptcy process. Would that specific bankruptcy be recognized by Beis Din because it is effectively giving a stamp of approval to theft?
So, as I understand it, as part of bankruptcy proceedings, that sort of thing would have to be disclosed, right? Would a secular court recognize that?
It's arguable that if the bankrupt declares fraud, you can, as a debtor, you can say, I have an equitable right to that money, and it trumps the lineup of creditors. Because don't forget, you may not be the only one who's lent money to the debtor.
Right.
So you may say, I come before even the secured creditors.
Correct.
But the question is, how would a Bastien treat it if there was, because if somebody's a thief, he's not going to declare it.
Right. So the general principle would be, and this is sort of jumping the line in terms of where we're going, but the general rule would be anything which the secular court would not have recognized had it known it is not going to be accepted in the Jewish court either, even if we honor the decision of the court, because the decision of the court itself is flawed. So that's going to transport over to the Jewish system also. But just to give more of the background on why the law of the land would be binding, another reason is in source number 14, in which we are told that one of the Noahide laws, one of the laws that applies to all human beings, who are called Noahides, not in order to advertise the Russell Crowe movie, but because that's what they're called in Jewish tradition. Non-Jews are called Noahides, descendants of Noah. So one of the Noahide laws is that they are required to set up courts. They're required to set up a legal system. If that's true, then you cannot, at the same time, require that people set up a system of law and then at the same time flout it and say, but we aren't going to respect it. If you're requiring that they set up a legal system, you also have to respect and honor that system, and therefore the law of the land is binding. And so that's a second reason why Jewish law will recognize decisions of the secular system. A third reason for it, and this is the last that I'll bring, is simply social contract. If you take a look at source number 15, a passage in the Talmud, townspeople may make rules for measures and prices and wages, and may fine those who violate the norms. The people of a community are entitled to make whatever rules they choose to make for how business is going to be conducted. So this is simply social contract. It's within the rights of society to make such rules. Okay, so the law of the land is the law. The question is, what's the scope? To what extent is the government able to do things, or the legal system able to do things? And that, of course, like everything in Judaism, is subject to some debate. Take a look, please, at source number 16. Source number 16 is from Rabbi Yosef Kolon Trabato, also known as Maharik, writing in Italy in the 15th century. And he suggests the following, and I'm going to read, in the interest of time, I'm just going to read the English out. I bring you the Hebrew so you can check it for those who have the Hebrew. It is possible to say that government law is the law, for the king says that his land may be acquired with their designated document. He's dealing with the purchase of land. So the king has said, you can buy the land with a deed, therefore it's yours. But even according to those views cited by the Mordechai in earlier authority, that government law is the law in other monetary matters beyond how you acquire land, that is specifically for head taxes and other practices of the kings, obviously. In civil law, it is most obvious that this is not so, for with this you would cancel all of the Torah's laws, God forbid. The position of Rabbi Kolon is that the only thing that is under this government system of Dina de Malchusa, that the law of the land is binding, is that which directly affects the king. Now, he's not dealing with a democratic system. But that which directly affects the government, and only that which directly affects the government, that which happens between citizens is not going to be covered. That's a narrow take. There's a broader take in source number 17. Rabbi Moshe Isserles, writing in 16th century Poland, gives me a much broader system which seems much more closely linked to social contract than to the powers of the, so to speak, owner of the land. He says, we do not recognize government law other than in matters that benefit the king or that benefit the citizenry. But not to judge by the laws of idolaters, that will cancel all the laws of Israel. There's a major concern about making sure that Torah law will still exist. But the basic statement is that there has to be a benefit for the king or for society. You follow? So if I were to take the first approach, that is only that which directly affects the government, would I recognize a bankruptcy discharge? Yes? No?
No.
No? You sure?
I don't know.
I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure. You could make an argument that this is for the benefit of the government, right? Based on the philosophies that we gave before for why you do this. You know, if the government is ultimately going to be responsible to spend funds to support these people who are living in debt, then maybe this is their benefit.
On the assumption that they're still a welfare state.
Yes, correct.
A welfare state, the government can care less.
But
true.
Taxes are relevant too. When someone goes bankrupt and then he's discharged and he can then proceed and earn a livelihood again, he can earn money and therefore pay taxes to the government.
It's not clear cut. I don't think it's clear cut. There was another hand over there. Okay. But I'm not sure. Clearly, though, within Rabbi Isserles' approach, in which he says that you can do something for the benefit of the citizenry, if your philosophy is that this is better for the community as a whole, then there's great room to say that this is going to be recognized, the secular bankruptcy discharge will be recognized by the law of the land.
In most bankruptcies, the vast majority of bankruptcies, the vast majority of the debt that is owed to government. So when we're talking about discharge, we're talking about discharge of a debt between the citizen and the government. And that might be relevant to the question, of the Malchusa, because you're talking about the responsibility for taxes.
Right. But if so, see, that there's a double-edged sword, right? In that sense, on the one hand, you could argue it's not for the benefit of the government. On the other hand, if the government chooses, what greater Dina de Malchusa is there, so to speak? What greater act of government is there than for the government to say, for Her Majesty to say, I am now waiving my claim? So I think that actually would make this a very strong argument for acceptance by the Jewish court. If the government itself says we're not going to claim it, why should the Jewish court be more frum, so to speak, more observant than the government? There is another approach in source number 18 to this law of the land disposition, in which it says, this is Rabbi Shabtai HaKohen, a principal commentator to the Code of Jewish Law. He says, even according to other authorities who think we honor government law in all matters, that is specifically when it does not oppose our Torah's laws, and there is nothing explicit in our laws. To use the laws of the nations in all matters against our Torah, God forbid, certainly such may not be done in Israel. He says, absolutely not. He says, since there's a religious duty to repay debts, you can't absolve yourself of your religious obligation based on the law of the land. He's very strong in that regard. So, whom do we follow among these opinions? So, Moshe Feinstein, in source number 19, offered a ruling on a corporate bankruptcy case, in which he followed Rabbi Isserles' position, and he offered a very expansive explanation of what is covered under the law of the land. He says, it appears certain that even those who accept government law in all matters only accept established government law in matters of transactions and payment of debts from one's assets. For the government would suffer if there were different laws among the people. He says, we will accept established government law in matters of transactions, even though it's between parties, not between me and the government, because the government it does not benefit when society has different rules for different people. That doesn't work well. It creates strife. It could lead to jealousy and competition and strife. This might appear to relate only to the laws of government-appointed national judges, but perhaps the king would also be concerned that other judges not judge in other ways which could cause challenges to the nation's laws. In other words, if you have different court systems running, and some are honoring and some are not honoring, that's going to create problems for the land as well. And so what Rabbi Feinstein articulates here is absolutely accepting the law of the land and doing so to accept a bankruptcy proposal as well. That's his position. Others do disagree, surprise, because that's the way we'd work. But take a look, for example, at source number 20, Rabbi Yaakov Breisch, who says, I disagree. Even according to Rabbi Moshe Isserles, who especially elevates the principle of honor in government law, extending it even to the benefit of the citizens, what benefit for the citizens would apply in our case? Stealing this person's assets because the borrower is temporarily unable to pay. He is unsympathetic to bankruptcy filing. He considers it theft. And he says, you're not benefiting society as well. It's all in how you read what's going on. That's why I said before, the philosophy matters. If I view bankruptcy as an institution that is meant to help borrowers, then I may well look at this as harming the lender and not to be honored and respected. But if I look at it as something that is for the benefit of society, right? Building entrepreneurship or making sure that you discourage crime, all the different explanations we can give, then I'm much more likely to say this fits into Dina de Mahusa, the law of the land, such that it ought to be honored.
That could conceivably explain the apparent contradiction between Reb Moshe and Rabbi Breisch.
Oh, yeah.
That they're dealing with different systems. The American as opposed to, I know, the Swiss or the German or some European system, which might have a different emphasis or different nuance.
That's a good point. I think in order to really... Rabbi Breisch's language is very strong. But you're right. It could be shaped by the system that he's seeing in Switzerland post-war.
Having said that, they're both 20th century.
Right, but the systems even now vary broadly from country to country. I did a little bit of research, not a whole lot, in terms of the bankruptcy systems of different countries, and yeah, there are real differences in terms of how much can be demanded of the debtor before the debt is going to be discharged.
So is it fair to say that the American system is more sympathetic to the borrower? Because if that's the case, then what you're saying now makes sense.
I don't know the Swiss system post-war is not familiar to me. So that's really what we need to know.
Or the German system.
Right. I know, but I think he wrote this post-war Switzerland. I believe that's where he published this. But it's a good question. I don't know. But this is a second argument, again, to make sure we understand where we've been and where we're going here. We talked about the fact that there is a religious duty in Judaism to pay one's debts. We talked about what happens if one cannot pay in the historical development of bankruptcy discharge, and the way that Judaism did not adopt that system. We suggested it may be because of the religious duty to repay. We suggested that it may be because you want to promote an environment of lending. There was a third suggestion that someone had volunteered that now I'm blanking on. I'm sorry. There was a third suggestion someone had made. I'm going to go with the two for now then, until I can watch the recording. But in terms of whether Jewish law will then recognize what's done in a secular court, the answer is if it's done through compromise, possibly with an act of kinyan, then it will be recognized, barring the argument of compulsion, which we have to come back to. It may be honored, though, under Dina de Mahusa, the law of the land, and Rabbi Feinstein certainly seems to go in that direction. The third one, which was suggested before, the third rationale for accepting is the argument of contemporary practice, or minhag socharim. So, source number 21, it talks about hiring employees to do a job for you and requiring certain things of them. And 21, a passage out of the Talmud says, in a place where workers neither rise early nor remain late at night, one may not force them to do so. Where the practice is to feed them, one must feed them. If it's normal for you to provide lunch, you got to provide lunch. Where the practice is to provide sweet food, snacks, you got to provide it. All is according to the custom of the land. That's not the same thing as law of the land. It's a basic statement that if there's a standard practice which people assume going into any relationship, you have to honor that. You have to honor that practice, so that if when people borrow money, they assume that they are going to have resort to bankruptcy because that's normal in the land, then you're going to need to honor that as well. Local custom can even empower judges to manipulate assets. If you look at the 15th century Code of Jewish Law, in source number 22, this is a very interesting example. In order to avoid conflict of interest, the rule is, in any matter that benefits a judge, he cannot judge. Right? You can't be the judge if something affects you personally. That's logical. Therefore, on communal tax matters, the local judges cannot judge, for they or their relatives will have a portion in it. Right? They're going to benefit somehow. However, if they, meaning the community, enacted or have a local custom that the local judges may even judge tax matters, then their verdict is valid. If people in the community say, we're good with the idea that this person is going to be a judge, that's their choice. So there's a broad authority for the community to create rules that are going to affect assets. And not only that, that is true even with rules created within the secular community. Take a look at source number 23. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, once again, dealing with a government regulation that authorized tenants to be able to stay after they had rented for a certain period of time, unless the tenant gave notice. So you had a landlord who said, I want to kick my tenant out after 2 years. And the tenant argued, too bad, the law allows me to stay. within the Jewish system, there's no such thing as a law that's going to allow your tenant to stay. The landlord would be entitled, after the expiration of the initial contract, to say, okay, I'm not renewing. So take a look at what Rabbi Feinstein wrote in source number 23. He says, for those who rented after the government's tenancy law was enacted, without an explicit condition requiring the tenant leave after the initial rental ended, are as though they had rented on conditions. These tenants are as though they had rented on condition that the government's law be followed. In other words, we assume that they meant to go with the local practice, as long as the rental occurred after the initial, after the law was passed, after that became standard practice. And that may be applied to bankruptcy. Source number 24, I quote you Rabbi Akiva Eger, a great authority in Jewish law from 18th century Poland, in which he says, responsa mazat Moshe, that's one work of law, quoted Maharshach, who was another authority in Jewish law who dealt with bankruptcy issues. He quoted Maharshach regarding creditors who agreed to compromise with a debtor, where one creditor did not agree for various reasons. So what happens in that case where you have a holdout creditor? I see grounds to compel the one who is refusing to compromise, like the others who are the majority, for it is normal business practice to compel the unwilling one to compromise. That's the way it's done. It's not a matter of law. It's a matter of popular custom. And so for this reason, this reason of popular practice, the bankruptcy discharge may well be recognized within Judaism. I realize this is very dense. There's an awful lot of text that we're throwing out here. I hope that that it's not too much. But what we're suggesting here is that, yes, the bankruptcy discharge will be recognized, certainly if it's achieved via compromise of the sides. And even if not, the argument may be made Dina de Malchus Adina, the recognition of government law, as Rabbi Feinstein contended, or even for those who reject the possibility of it being recognized under government law, it will still be recognized as part of standard business practice. This is what happens. And that's certainly so if you're dealing with a corporation situation, when you're dealing with something that functions under secular law in general. This will, as opposed to a private debt, this will certainly be so. Okay. So that answers our first question. The other two questions become much easier now. Once you've said that the secular agreement is going to be honored one way or another, the other two questions are much more straightforward. So our second question is, under Jewish law, may I aid my client in filing for bankruptcy? This is an ethical question. I am making two assumptions, one of which goes back to Chuck's question from before. One, assumption number one, the client is legitimately broke. The client is not deceiving the parties. The client is not concealing assets. The client is not engaging in impropriety. I am assuming that you have a client who is Jewish, who wants to honor Jewish law, and who simply doesn't have the money to pay. That's number one. Number two, what I'm not going to discuss, although it's worth a discussion at some point, but it would just make this too long, is the question of lifnei iver, which says that I am not allowed to lead somebody into stumbling. So if he's a Jew and he's not supposed to violate Jewish law, then maybe I am causing him to stumble by enabling him to do this and violating his religious duty to repay. So that's a nuance here, which I'm not going to discuss right now here, because we have to discuss whether this is inappropriate at all. Maybe it's not inappropriate for him to do this. After all, we've said that we can recognize the agreement. Yes?
The difference between people who don't have any money, their businesses is going or gone, but they have their own personal money because they have a business set up in the company and they have their own personal money. So how do we...
Good. Good. So I actually had a note on this that I skipped in the interest of time, but now I'll mention it. And that is, in a corporate situation in which individual directors are indemnified, which I think applies to what you're describing, even if it's not a corporation, what you're talking about, but you have a legal structure in which you have personal assets, and then you have that which is exposed for payment of the debt, they would seem to be protected because they entered into the debt with a full statement that they would not be personally responsible, that their personal assets would not be used. In other words, to put it the other way, the creditor has no justification for expecting that they were going to get those funds. So therefore, my understanding is that this would be fine. That's the way I understand it. Halachically correct.
Usually someone guarantees it.
And that's his own question, going after the guarantor. who never expected that this was going to happen to them.
But if a creditor, you have a Jewish creditor intends on repaying, and I don't know whether it matters whether it's a Jewish or non-Jewish. A Jewish debtor who wants to repay. Right. A Jewish or non-Jewish creditor petitions him into bankruptcy.
Yeah.
So doesn't that bring a totally different question? Because if he intended to pay, but then he was forced into the situation,
then I don't see how anyone could object.
But could a Jewish creditor then say, if he actually intended to pay it?
Yeah.
Does that maybe take him out of the protection because that there was no spirit of pshara, there was no, he was forced into it? Does he then, with that intention, still have to pay post-discharge?
I don't think so. I think if we recognize the discharge is valid, his intentions are great and it would be wonderful for him to act on them, but I'm not clear on why he should be able to be compelled if later on he realizes this isn't doable. That's my understanding. Once we're recognizing it, we're recognizing it, intentions notwithstanding. So it appears to me. So in this discussion of helping my client to do this, we answered the question already of whether this bankruptcy agreement is going to be legitimate in the eyes of Jewish law. Is use of the proceedings a subversion of the religious duty to pay his debts? So, assuming that bankruptcy is considered a legitimate means of dealing with situations, then the answer would seem to be no. He's not subverting his religious obligation. This is all part of borrowing. In the same way, we say, if Party A borrows money from Party B, and forget bankruptcy, Party B says, you know what, you don't have to pay me back. You know, I like you, whatever it is, you don't have to pay me back. Then that's it. Case closed. He has no further obligation to repay. So I see no reason why a legitimate use of the process would not lead to the same result. It's not considered a subversion of his duties. However, there's a separate problem. And the separate problem is broader than we're going to be able to discuss in depth here, but the problem of going to a secular court. Remember that within Jewish law, we are told that when Jews are dealing with legal matters, they're supposed to go to a Jewish court. And I brought you sources on this here, but I'm just going to state them outside the text. One reason for it is concern for showing preference for the secular system looks like a disgrace to the Jewish system of law. A second reason why is because it might undermine continuity of the Jewish system. As Jews start going to the secular system, you will necessarily have a reduction in the number of people who are dealing with practically the Jewish law, and then it's going to the system will become defunct simply as no one uses it. And then the third is that law in general within Judaism is considered a religious experience. We talked about this before as a mitzvah, as a commandment to actually handle affairs between people in a legal manner, justly and fairly. I brought you source 28 in this regard about a judge who judges truthfully causing the Shekhinah, manifestation of God, in Israel. It's considered a religious thing. If you're now going to do this in a secular system, you're undermining the religious character of justice. So for all those reasons, we prefer that they go to a Jewish court, not to a secular court. So how do you deal with this? The truth of the matter is, a Jewish court may grant somebody permission to go to secular court if they want to claim money from from somebody else, and they can't do it in a Jewish court, so they may get license from a Jewish court to go outside the Jewish system. But it's not going to pertain here, because here it's the debtor, I'm assuming, that it's the debtor who wants to go to the bankruptcy court. It's not the creditor who normally wants to go. Yes?
If I could just say that I think there's a big question about whether recourse to bankruptcy court should be regarded as litigation at all, in rather the same way as going to a court for a divorce, in some respects, is not litigation. Because what you're doing is you're asking the government to do something for you.
It's called a petition. It's different than litigation.
In private international law, they make a distinction between executive acts and judicial acts. And the granting of a divorce, in the same way as a bankruptcy, seems to me to be more an executive than a judicial act.
Very good.
What you're doing,
I'm going to agree with you.
Okay, sure.
If you take a look at source 29, the argument is made by Professor Steven Reznikoff in that article that I referenced in the very beginning. He says a bankruptcy is technically an in rem proceeding, i.e., the debtor does not affirmatively sue anyone in court. Instead, the debtor merely appears before the court and seeks its relief. At least where there is no dispute as to the debtor's eligibility for a discharge, the secular court arguably does not adjudicate legal issues between, quote, parties. In such cases, by filing for bankruptcy relief, the debtor is essentially applying to a government office for a special permit or benefit, not submitting to a court for the resolution of a dispute. So the argument may well be made that this is not a problem, but the upshot of this is that if we're recognizing this, if we're recognizing this within the secular system, that yes, there's nothing unethical or anti-Judaism about doing this. We did announce this as an hour and a quarter class, so I'm free of fraud in this regard. But in the event that someone has to leave, please make sure that you've signed in so I can follow up on items from the class. There inevitably thoughts come up afterwards that I'm going to want to email out about. So make sure that you do sign in, please. The last of our questions. My Jewish client is filing for bankruptcy. How can I protect him from challenge in a Jewish court? So this was really interesting in terms of the way this played out, because as I did more research on it, I discovered that this may be entirely moot. Because I consulted a few different lawyers and experts on this issue, and one of them, Rabbi Michael Broyd, pointed out to me a U.S. case in which it was noted that this was a case in which there was an attempt to challenge, not to challenge, to collect in a rabbinical court after there was already a discharge in a secular court. And the answer was you can't, because there's a stay of proceedings once somebody files the proposal. And the stay of proceedings says no one, certainly in the American system, is allowed to then further pursue a debt that's already been discharged by the bankruptcy. Now, someone correct me, in Canadian law, I mean, I read through Section 69, or a lot of it, of the Bankruptcy and Insolvency Act, but it seemed to me the same protection applies there. Is that correct?
Yes.
So if the same protection really does apply there, then this question is moot. You don't have anything to worry about. They can't do it. And as a matter of fact, although in the case that our bird referred me to was very interesting, they raised the question whether under First Amendment rights in the U.S. and freedom of expression, you would be allowed to go to the religious court because it's protected under that. It wasn't resolved there. But I think that in Canada, you're not going to see that sort of thing go on. Yes?
A person can't be sued for a debt after they're discharged. That doesn't mean they don't have a religious obligation or that someone can't take it to the basement. They can't go to a secular court and say, the religious court said that he still has to pay me. But
right.
The religious court's not bound by that state of proceedings.
Well, once the religious court takes action, I think that's where they cross the line. Meaning, in the case that I had read, the U.S. case, they issued what's called a siruv. And a siruv is a document in which you declare that someone is refusing to go to court. And depending on your community, ramifications of a siruv can include children being removed from school, can include the all sorts of sanctions against commercial involvement with the party who's under it. And I think once they do that, are they not crossing the line of what the government was trying to prohibit with their stay of proceedings?
Stay of proceedings means they can't be sued for it, but that doesn't mean that, you know, there isn't some underlying stuff within the Jewish community.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Then my question is still a question, and we have reasons to go through sources 30 to 35.
I thought we studied all morning, and it's okay.
Right.
Jewish law, so if it's okay, it's okay.
Ah, and the answer
is... Yeah, hold your head up.
Right.
Does Jewish law recognize the sacred bankruptcy charge?
Ah.
He said yes.
So the answer to that is that inevitably, you will have those who will disagree. Meaning, you will have those who will say, I don't side with Rabbi Isserles regarding law of the land, and Rav Moshe, therefore, who sides with Rabbi Isserles, and therefore I don't recognize it under law of the land. And in terms of general practice, popular customary practice, they may say, well, in this loan, the creditor didn't expect that that was going to be an issue because the borrower had certain assets that he presented that showed that it looked like they would never go bankrupt, or it's a private loan, not a corporate situation, and who really lends to somebody personally thinking that that's going to happen. That you could make a case within a Jewish court to not recognize the bankruptcy, and then at that point this question becomes relevant. Yes?
If you're not happy with the decision regarding your debt in a Jewish court, can you go to the civil court after that?
if you're not happy, in other words, you went to the Jewish court instead, and the Jewish court said what?
It's either one part or you don't owe the money, or you owe the money, or you owe half the money. Are you bound by the decision that the Beis Din stole the Beis Din?
Right. So generally speaking, when you enter a Beis Din, you're going to sign an agreement that says these are the parties who are going to resolve our dispute. And any sort of appeals process will be specified there. And to break that would be breaking that commitment that you made there. Yes, Eddie. Eddie and then Mark.
So if Jewish law had a system of bankruptcy, right, then these questions wouldn't apply, I guess.
Correct.
So the thing is, we said, when we talked about why bankruptcy came about in the first place, we said to protect the commerce and society so that people would, and, but then we said that one reason Jewish law didn't have it, also because Jewish law permits, so it's sort of...
Yes.
You know,
The answer is you're right, as the joke goes. The answer is that both sides of this are trying to promote what they believe is the better welfare of society and coming at it in different ways. The secular system is saying it's better for society to make sure that this either, whatever, you know, all the different reasons that we gave why it's going to be good for society. It's better to make responsible, you know, to make responsible lending. It's better to avoid crime or whatever it is. Jewish law traditionally placed a great emphasis on aiding the lender to compensate for the fact that the lender couldn't lend and charge interest and to make this philanthropic act more likely. That's really where the emphasis was. But you're right. They're both trying to accomplish the same goal.
Margaret. Sorry, if I can answer before you go on. Jewish law is more capitalist than secular law.
I wouldn't say that entirely. When you go back to Talmudic discussions, they had all sorts of price fixing going on. Like the gas stations here, you know, where they're all on the same price. Like you had that in your entire market. So it's not so clear. The capitalism versus socialism thing is not so clear. Yes?
Yeah, you know, one of the other issues that was raised here was the enforceability of the SOC. Given Section 69 of the Bankruptcy and Insolvency Act, or even other issues that might militate against the arbitration award, which is essentially what the Beis Din Tzedak is. So it could be that the secular courts won't recognize the Tzedak of the Beis Din in light of some of these other
things. Right. Just to mention, Tzedak is a ruling, so just so we understand the statement, but you're right. That may be an issue also. So a couple of thoughts just to address this. One argument which Professor Reznikoff raises and then dismisses is the argument that's called Yeush. Those who go to Jewish day school and study Talmud there in grades 5, 6, 7, at some point encounter a discussion about what's called Yeush. Yeush means abandonment of hope. And it's one of the first things that they teach kids about. No statement about abandonment of hope, but about abandonment of hope financially when you have a claim on somebody. They talk there about if you lose something and then somebody else finds it, so do we say, well, if you lost hope of getting it back, they have to return it to you, they don't have to return it to you, that sort of thing. So the question here is, could we say, once the secular court gave its ruling, then the creditor gave up hope of getting it back, of getting paid, and therefore he has no further claim? And the answer in brief is, no, that doesn't work. If there is Yeush, if he abandons hope because the debtor has no money, that may work. Then it may that may be effective. But generally speaking, giving up hope because the debtor has filed for bankruptcy is problematic. And I gave you sources here, which are great sources, and they're a lot of fun, but it's going to take us past the time. I'm going to single out source number 31, where Maharik, Rabbi Yosef Kolon, pointed out why abandonment of hope doesn't work. He said, you're always in doubt about whether you're going to get paid. That's the way credit works. And often you make false assumptions. A person may assume that somebody is poor and he actually has the means. We're not going to now say, because you thought that your debtor didn't have the means, now you can't get paid back. That's not the way it works. You're not privy to all the information. You may assume somebody is powerful and unwilling to pay and he's going to use his connections in order to avoid paying, and it's not true. So the hesitations and doubts of the creditor are not going to be effective to cause cancellation of the debt. That's number one. But number two, in source 33, Rabbi Meir Auerbach, writing in 19th century Poland, pointed out that here the borrower has actually done something to cause the abandonment of hope. And then it doesn't work. So for example, let's take it to the case of the lost object, right? I find your phone. Right? The phone was left on the table after the class. So you leave, right? And you assume you're going to get the phone back. When you realize that it's missing, you think you're going to walk back in and it's going to be sitting on the table. Because, after all, these are all nice people. It's in a synagogue. For sure, who's going to take something? And so you think, I'm going to come back and get the phone. I notice the phone here. I take the phone off the table and I hide it somewhere. You come back, the phone's gone. You think, ugh, I'm never going to see this phone again. Does that work? No. Because I engaged in an illicit act in order to cause you to abandon hope. That doesn't work. So if we don't recognize bankruptcy in Jewish law, then the fact that I went and got a bankruptcy ruling isn't going to cause any recognized abandonment of hope. It was my fault. I did something. So therefore, that's not going to be an issue. Not only that, I mentioned in the beginning that where there is a compromise between parties, compromise will work, assuming you did Kenya. However, as I noted to Mark at the time, there is this potential of arguing in response, I only agreed because I had no choice. That doesn't work. Take a look at source 35, the last of the sources. If Reuven intimidated Shimon, two parties, Reuven and Shimon, if Reuven intimidated Shimon by threatening to turn him over to an Anas, Anas is a powerful figure who is some kind of crime lord, and you don't want to cross him. So if Reuven intimidated Shimon by threatening to turn him over to an Anas if he wouldn't pay the disputed sum, and Reuven possessed no legal right to it. In other words, I go to him and I say, I want $1 million. And if you don't have $1 million to give me, you're going to be swimming with the fishes. That's my statement to him. Not a bankruptcy case, just a general case. And I have no right to $1 million. And as a result of this intimidation, he says, okay. And he does whatever act of kinyan is necessary in order to certify that he's going to pay me $1 million. That agreement is not going to stand up in court. And even if as part of the agreement he does what's called a bitul moda'a, he declares, I formally renounce all claims against this agreement, I formally announce all ability to challenge this agreement. Of course he's doing that because there's a gun to his head behind the camera. It's duress. So it's not going to be agreed to. So therefore the argument can be made that even if there's a compromise, it's not going to be recognized within Jewish law. So then what are your options? So here I'm going to call the fact that it's already at an hour and a quarter, and I'm going to give you my answer. And I'll stick around for questions afterwards. A couple of pieces of advice that I received from Rabbi Michael Broyd as well as from Rabbi Usher Mayer, who has a business ethics institute in Jerusalem. Number one, where possible, at the origination of the loan, make sure that the agreement includes a clause stipulating that disagreements related to payment of the loan will be managed by a particular Jewish court that you know recognizes bankruptcy discharge. So in other words, pick your court from the beginning. Make sure that your agreement actually includes a mechanism for dealing with this situation, whatever mechanism it is that you want. That's one approach. What if that didn't happen in the beginning? So if that wasn't done, then what you should do as a condition of the bankruptcy proposal is require the creditor to agree that if he is going to pursue the claim, he's going to do it in a particular religious court that you both accept. And that would be the other way to deal with it, because again, you will pick a religious court that will recognize the bankruptcy discharge. But this is what you want your client to do as part of the agreement in order to make sure that the bankruptcy will be honored afterwards. What we've done is we've covered an awful lot of ground. If people have to leave while I summarize, that's fine. We're going to take 1 minute to summarize. But we said that Jewish law, that secular law has, at least since the 16th century, had bankruptcy legislation, perhaps as far back as Solon, as a form of it, to help the creditor by getting cooperation, to give the debtor another chance, to avoid crime, to help society in general. Jewish law requires repayment of a debt as a religious duty. We don't imprison or enslave or oppress the borrower, but the debt remains. Jewish law may recognize a secular bankruptcy discharge if it's achieved via willing compromise, or under government law, or under popular practice. May I aid my client in filing for bankruptcy? So assuming he's doing this legitimately, he's not cheating somebody, going to secular court may be a problem, but it may not be, because this isn't true litigation, as was pointed out. And in terms of bankruptcy itself, if I follow the principles of either government law recognizing this or Rabbi Akiva Eger regarding popular practice, then the bankruptcy agreement will be fine. And last, if the Jewish client is filing for bankruptcy, how can I protect him from challenge? So the stay may make this moot. But in the event that it doesn't, you can't rely on the creditor giving up hope. What you would need instead is some kind of an agreement at the origination of the loan, or at the time of the bankruptcy, setting a court that you believe will be friendly to this bankruptcy agreement as the rabbinic court that's going to handle the case. Obviously, we believe down the line that it's better for people to pay debts. We have a religious duty to do so. And the fact that you have an option of resorting to bankruptcy doesn't change that. So that's always what we're going to prefer. But in a case where that becomes impossible, this would be an outline of the way to deal with it. Thank you very much.